This is, in fact, I think, to a large extent, what we can attribute a lot of these things we've been talking about to. Dave mentioned things going on in Central America. I mean, we've seen it all the way through. We've seen it in South America. The whole Chilean revolution was brought about not just by the CIA, but because AT&T and Anaconda Copper and other companies felt uncomfortable. United Fruit was upset about Guatemala, so we brought the CIA-trained armies in and threw them over. So bear in mind, when we're talking about this stuff happening in Russia, this is not an isolated incident. There are precedences, there are antecedents that date back well into the 19th century, and there are current additions, such as Nicaragua, that are going on right now. So it's nothing new.
Notice also the involvement of the United States in what one might call a quagmire. Certainly most of the, many of the commanders, many of the troops who were involved in the American Expeditionary Force that had intervened in the Russian Civil War had very disparaging things to say about the comet. The troop morale was extremely low. They saw no reason for fighting, and it became a quagmire. But notice the involvement of the United States in such a quagmire for oil. And keep in mind all of those oil companies and the $1 billion worth of property that Hoover had. And, well, today, of course, oil, we hear so much about the threat to our oil supplies and how we have to do this, that, or the other thing. So, again, it's a pattern which we see right at the outset of the confrontation between the Soviet Union, the United States, and the other Western powers. And the one thing to add along those same lines is the fact that political ideology often in these sorts of things doesn't count for as much in and of itself as people might be led to suspect, that very often things are not done for ideological reasons, either on the left or the right, but rather they're done in order to gain the goodies. And so one could say that Herbert Hoover was an anti-Bolshevist, but the question is, was he an ideologue, or did he simply want to hang on to his $1 billion?
Right. A good example, in fact, and something we're going to be talking about later, even in this show, we'll be starting to touch on some of this, is the fact that quite a few of the people who initially helped Adolf Hitler into power in Germany were, in fact, Jewish industrialists who didn't really worry about the ideological stuff. They went, oh, he's another right-wing ideologue. The point is that he'll protect our business interests from the Bolsheviks. And, of course, sometimes the ideology does prove to be sort of a problem to people who hadn't expected it to be.
Well, indeed, Hitler, there were certain wealthy, very powerful Jews who, if they were willing to support Nazism and contribute some of their financing to the German war effort and the Nazi political effort, were declared, quote, honorary Aryans and were allowed to survive in great comfort. Indeed, were integral parts of the Third Reich. So, again, all of this is to say that often it's the goodies and not the ideology that make the world go round.
Indeed. This is Nip Tuck. I'm here in the studios at KFJC with Dave Emery. We are now going into the second hour of Radio Free America, the archive show. Tonight's show is Looking Back from 1984, Hidden History of the Cold War. It wasn't meant to rhyme. It just came out that way. We've got a bunch of stuff to talk about. Somebody just bumped into me in the lobby. Don Surrath, who does People in Peninsula Politics up here, P3. And Don said, gee, I hadn't heard a lot of that stuff. And I said to Don, boy, it's going to get even weirder in the rest of this show, because a lot of this stuff, indeed, people have not heard. And that's one of the key things that we're trying to deal with here. And one of the key reasons for putting these kinds of shows together, because as we mentioned, a lot of the material we're dealing with was stuff that was very respectable, coming from well-known and well-respected researchers when it came out in the 30s, 40s, 50s. But by the time the early 50s and middle 50s had rolled past and the juggernaut of McCarthyism was on its way, most of these dissenting voices were basically rubbed out like bugs. And, of course, there was nothing short of a witch hunt, and people who had dissenting views were basically driven out of public life. Not only writers and researchers and people like that, but politicians, people of dissenting views in the State Department, all over the place. So what we're trying to do is in part, only in part, resurrect some of these lost voices, because the things that they said are no less true for the fact that the government didn't like them saying it.
Basically, we're trying to uncover the works of these people who were shoved under during the McCarthy period, and we're trying to uncover the works that have been buried by the shifting sands of history, so to speak. What we're really going to be doing is explaining to you how the seeming reversal of roles in which the United States and the Soviet Union were wartime allies, how that really was not such a reversal, and how even though the United States and the Soviet Union were allied during World War II, really there was a conflict between the two countries and also between the Soviet Union and Britain and France, which stretched from the very outset of the Soviet Union, the Bolshevik Revolution, which brought that country into being in its present form, and it stretches right up to today, and it went clean on through the Second World War, even though the United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union were technically speaking military allies, and actually did both sides, that is, contributed very materially, of course, to the defeat of Hitler and the Axis powers. Now, speaking of Hitler and the Axis powers, in a nutshell, fascism came into being as a reaction against socialism. In Germany, basically, World War I came to an end when, in imitation of the people of the Soviet Union, the workers and soldiers in Germany, basically, who were very sick of two things. They were sick of the extreme economic hardship brought on by the British blockade, which had prevented German industry from gaining many of the raw materials which were essential for production, and they were also sick of facing certain death in the trenches. Almost the entire so-called lost generation in Europe was exterminated during the First World War. So basically, in 1918, the German workers and soldiers and sailors hoisted the red flag and had a revolution similar to the one in the Soviet Union in certain respects. They set up workers' and soldiers' Soviets, or councils, to govern themselves. The difference is that the revolution in Germany was unsuccessful. There are many views why. Most people sort of agree that basically there was a larger middle class in Germany who simply were not ready to overturn the social order, and this middle class lent its support to the Social Democrats, headed by Friedrich Ebert, the president of the new Weimar Republic, and basically Ebert kept the general staff and the army in power and used that general staff and army to suppress the German Revolution. Now, after the German during the course of the suppression of this German Revolution, a young German army intelligence agent named Adolf Schickelgruber infiltrated the abortive German Revolution in the Munich area. Now, he infiltrated this revolution under the most commonly used of his several aliases, that of Adolf Hitler. Okay, and he infiltrated the workers and soldiers Soviets in Munich, the sort of the Bolshevik the Soviet government of Munich, and after the army had suppressed it, he fingered all the leaders, who were then promptly taken out and shot. Now, after that, Adolf Hitler, and remember his real name was Adolf Schickelgruber, acting on assignment, remember he was a German army intelligence agent, infiltrated a defunct political party, the German National Workers' Party, or the German Socialist Workers' Party, and together with a number of other German army undercover German army informants, notably Rudolf Hess, Alfred Rosenberg, Ernst Röhm, a guy named Dietrich Eckert, and a fellow named Gottfried Feder, Hitler basically founded the Nazi Party, the German National Socialist Workers' Party, which essentially, in its initial stages, was nothing more than a front for German military intelligence. And the German army was basically, or the Nazi Party, rather, was used as a vehicle for the introduction of the German army into civilian life in order to suppress the revolution. So you had supposedly demobilized German army units up to company strength being enlisted in the Nazi Party and then promptly turned out in the uniform of the SA, the Brown Shirts, the Sturmabteilung, who basically provided the muscle for Hitler's radical right-wing political ideas. Now, the democratic leadership of Germany was systematically assassinated by underground German army units, ostensibly operating on their own, but in point of fact, coordinated by the German general staff. Now, the general staff member who ran them was General von Epp, last name EPP, and the liaison officer between these assassination units, known alternately as the Freikorps or Free Corps and the so-called Black Reichswehr, the underground German army. These units had Femic assassination units. The assassination teams themselves were known as the Fema, in imitation of an ancient rural terror group that had been used by the German Junkers, the German aristocratic landholders. Basically, they said these Freikorps and Black Reichswehr assassination units wiped out the democratic leadership of Germany. Simply killed them all off. The man who coordinated these killings was Ernst Röhm. Again, an undercover German army informant who was the liaison man between von Epp and the Freikorps, and Ernst Röhm becomes head of the Brown Shirts. In Italy, a similar thing happened. Faced with a radical, certainly very vocal, very well organized, very active radical left, the dominant industrialists and financiers of Italy, in cooperation with the Catholic Church, lent their support to a fellow by the name of Benito Mussolini, initially a leftist. Mussolini and his fascisti, Mussolini coined the word fascism, basically took power in Italy, seized power, and proceeded to set up a radical right-wing government and to not only structure Italian political life for the benefit of large corporations and industrial interests, but indeed to pattern Italian political life after the sort of command structure of a corporation in which instructions are handed down from the executive officers and basically everyone else in the company follows their will without any independent voice, or at least not a great deal of executive control over what it is they're going to do. When asked by a journalist what fascism is, Mussolini gave two one-word definitions. And remember, Mussolini invented the word fascism. He said, fascism is reaction, which is not that specific a term. He also said, fascism is corporatism, and that's an interesting word to contemplate. And so you had these two radical right-wing movements arising in Europe as basically a response to or a reaction to socialism and the advent of the first socialist government in the world, which was the first socialist country in the world, which was the Soviet Union, and the strong upsurge in left-wing activity all over Europe.
Now, bear in mind, before we get back to Benito Mussolini, who we are going to touch on again for a moment, bear in mind once again, the historical parallels that we see, and we have seen, and we will continue to see, no doubt, which is of a country breaking free from a long siege underneath a repressive, usually oligarchical government, as the Soviet Union did out from underneath the government of the Tsar. And as we have seen Nicaragua do, escaping from the Somocista regime, and things of that nature. And bear in mind also the connections between these and the advent, at this point, of death squads, which are in essence a secret and deniable, or supposedly deniable arm of the military. And it consists of military men and is set free on the populace with the express permission and encouragement of the military, and in fact usually run secretly by the military. The militarization of a reactionary government, in fact giving the power over to the military with power of life or death over the citizens, and the quick disappearance of any form of democracy whatsoever, the suppression of newspapers, the suppression of dissent, the suppression of meetings and convocations, and things of that nature, and the quick murder of most of the dissident population.
Perhaps
anyway.
Significantly, the suppression of freedom in the name of freedom.
Indeed, yes, yes. National security becomes paramount, and anybody who does not agree with that quickly becomes a statistic. And again, we see this very commonly, and national security is used as the excuse and the suppression of communism. And once again, any sane person, regardless of their political outlook on things, has to look at these situations and say, well, is it really worthwhile killing the entire country to save it from socialism, or turning around to look again at what Henry Kissinger said about Chile? Henry Kissinger said, well, the United States is not going to stand idly by and watch Chile go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people. So you can think about that for a moment. Now, in the United States in the 20s and 30s, as these burgeoning fascist movements sprung up in reaction to socialism in Europe and to the attempt of the mostly captured nations or nations who'd been in really bad shape during the war in response to their attempts to govern themselves, well, in the United States, needless to say, land of business opportunity, there was a lot of support in many circles for these burgeoning fascist movements. One of the very popular ones was Mussolini's fascist movement in Italy. And one of his main groups of supporters in the United States was the American Legion. A former American Legion head said, for instance, that the fascisti were to Italy what the American Legion was to the United States, namely ex-servicemen willing to take a part in politics, et cetera, et cetera.
Keep in mind, too, that the American Legion, at least in its early days and during the period when fascism was in flower in Europe, and quite possibly today, too, I don't know, was very closely affiliated with, and in essence, an arm of the National Association of Manufacturers, which is sort of a pan-industrialist group, an industrial council, which really wields a tremendous, one could say, pivotal influence in this country today. And it is, as its name implies, the National Association of Manufacturers, although it's dominated by the very large industrial interests.
All right. Now, again, I'm just going to touch on a brief point here, but it's important to realize there was vast support. And in the 1930s, despite the fact that in Germany and Italy, already the fascist government in Italy and the Nazi government of Germany had gone to the point of literally executing dissidents, dragging people off the street for mere opposition to the regime. People were being shot dead. People were being dragged away in full public view, imprisoned, in the very mildest cases, exiled, and very few times did people actually escape assassination and wind up with only exile. So anyway, this was going on in the 1930s in the full view of the world, and yet, among such groups as the American Legion, there was still very strong support for fascism and Nazism and the fact that the trains were running on time. And reading just a very brief segment here out of a book called Facts and Fascism, which Dave mentioned earlier, by George Seldes, Mr. Seldes writes that in 1935, Colonel William E. Easterwood, who was the National Vice Commander of the American Legion, invited Benito Mussolini to the Chicago Convention of the Legion, made the Duce an honorary member of the American Legion, and pinned a button on him. Well, since the Legion has no honorary members, this action was later declared unconstitutional. But you get the general idea. This was only one of many overtures made to Mussolini by the American Legion. They were flurrying him with invitations right and left. They thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
And again, this may seem like sort of a fantastic thing to those of you who associate the American Legion with the red, white, and blue and with patriotic elements, patriotic identifications. And of course, Mussolini was an enemy of the United States, and American soldiers, American GIs died ousting his regime in Italy. So this may come as something of a shock to realize how popular he was. It's worth noting that also Henry Ford was decorated by Adolf Hitler for his prominent financial support, the enormous financial support that Henry Ford lent to Hitler. And he received the highest award that Hitler could give a foreigner, and it was only the fourth person to receive that award. One of the previous three was Benito Mussolini.
And also Henry Ford was his own writings, Henry Ford's anti-Jewish writings that were originally published in his newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, and were later compiled into a book called The International Jew. This is Henry Ford, the guy who's
had a better idea.
Successors, yes, came up with the Mustang, et cetera, et cetera. This book, The International Jew, of Ford's anti-Semitic writings, was one of the key elements of formation on the Nazis and on Hitler's own psychology and Mein Kampf and the whole schmear.
It's worth noting it was ghostwritten for him by an Okhrana prosecutor, an old Tsarist Secret Service prosecutor named Boris Brassel, who'd come to the United States even before the onset of Bolshevism, before the Bolshevik Revolution, and had begun working with the Ford Industrial Empire generating this anti-Semitic propaganda. So, once again, we see a Tsarist, a reactionary from the newly overthrown Tsarist regime, going abroad and continuing to conspire with foreign industrial interests in order to try and effect an eventual return to the Soviet Union.
Now, not only was there support from such groups as the National Association of Manufacturers and their almost subsidiary, the American Legion, there were support from many, many other quarters, the reactionary elements of Congress, and in some cases, the most powerful types of influence brought to bear in America in favor of fascism and anti-communism at all costs were from the journalistic sector, from the Fifth Estate. And we're going to mention a couple of those right now. We're going to talk about the Hearst Press for a moment. A little later on, we're going to bring up a name that has been in the news just lately, also having to do with the suppression and changing of news in favor of quote-unquote anti-communist, in reality, fascist groups.
All righty. Now, again, as with the attempt to induct Mussolini into the American Legion, the historical record really hasn't preserved for the American people the high regard in which fascism was held by a large and very powerful section of the American population. Now, one of the indications of just how popular fascism was among certain people and how relatively common or at least accepted it was by people who may not have necessarily supported it but certainly took it for granted is the fact that many key fascist leaders were able to get front page editorials in the Hearst Press. Now, of course, William Randolph Hearst and his son William Randolph Hearst Jr. are two of the linchpins of American journalism, and they own a tremendous chain of newspapers, which in turn are also very much involved. They own some radio and television stations, and the Hearst Press has a particular relevance for those of us who are here in the San Francisco Bay Area, since the San Francisco Examiner is a Hearst paper, and the Examiner owns 50% of the Chronicle, and the Hearst Corporation also, I believe, owns Channel 4 now. And so the Hearst Press, the Hearst journalistic interests are extremely important for those of us in the Bay Area and for other metropolitan areas and for the rest of the country as a whole. Before getting to these front page editorials by various fascists, let me read you, this is from George Seldes' Facts and Fascism, in fact, Incorporated 43, what in 1943 constituted the Hearst paper chain, the chain of Hearst newspapers. Seldes writes as follows: the New York Journal, American, and Mirror, the Albany Times Union, the Boston Record, the Boston American, and the Boston Advertiser, the Baltimore News Post, or no, I guess this is the Baltimore News Post and American, the Pittsburgh Sun, to the Pittsburgh Sun Telegraph, the Chicago Herald American, the Milwaukee News Sentinel, the Detroit Times, the San Francisco Examiner, the San Francisco Call Bulletin, the Oakland Post Inquirer, the Los Angeles Examiner and Herald Express, and the San Antonio Light, and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. That's quite a chain of newspapers, and what these newspapers were generating in the 1930s were things like the following. Now is turn of other nations to meet Germany's desire for peace. This is a front-page editorial by Alfred Rosenberg. Alfred Rosenberg was one of the original undercover German army agents to infiltrate the German Socialist Workers' Party and to turn it into the Nazi Party along with Hitler. He was a white Baltic, a citizen, basically a white Russian. He had been a citizen of the Baltic states, and just like Boris Brassel, who worked with Ford, he emigrated and began plotting with foreign elements against the Soviet Union. Worth noting that Alfred Rosenberg was the man who introduced the Protocols of the Elders of Zion to the Nazi Party, the fraudulent document which presents itself as the Doctrine for Jewish World Domination. Alfred Rosenberg was the chief theoretician of the Nazis' Aryan supremacist doctrine. Okay, and here we have a front-page editorial on the New York American saying, now is the turn of other nations to meet Germany's desire for peace. Another one, this from the New York American. Italy glories in militarism, says Duce. Pacifists, the worst enemies of peace. This is a front-page editorial in that same paper by Benito Mussolini. Also from the New York American. Reich training youth to build up air force, but not for war. Goering. This, of course, is Reichsmarschall General Hermann Wilhelm Goering, the head of the German Air Force, which basically burned and bombed and strafed its way into the annals of evil. And here he is on a front page editorial saying, "No, don't worry about the German Air Force. We're building up, but it's just for peace."
I should just mention real quickly again, for those of you who are not as familiar, perhaps, as Dave and I are with some of the stuff that we're talking about, that it needs to be said, too, that now at the same time that Goering was talking about how, we're building up the Air Force, but only for peace, quite most of Germany's military buildup was in direct contravention with the established laws and the accords that had come about at the end of World War I, and where they were, in fact, only able to carry these things out because of covert assistance from places like the United States, England, and France, and the blind eye that the official governments turned to those to that behavior, that in fact that it was not that they were just supposed to be building an air force and we hoped that it was for peaceful purposes, but in fact they were not supposed to be building any air force at all.
And we're going to tell you in just a couple of minutes about how they went about building at least part of that Air Force. Now, one of the things that's worth noting is that industrialists throughout the world, as we mentioned, saw fascism as sort of an antidote to socialism. And what they began doing, since they felt that any reactionary government, even a foreign reactionary government, would be preferable to a socialist government, because it presumably would allow a foreign fascist government would allow the large industrialists to retain at least some of their privileges. They began, many key industrialists, both in the United States and in Europe, began actively supporting Germany, which they saw kind of in two ways. They saw it as the, they saw the Nazis as the hitmen against Soviet Russia for reactionary industrialists. So they saw it as their, basically the means for knocking Russia out of the box. They also saw the Nazis as sort of the European equivalent of the coal and iron police, as sort of super labor goons to see to it that socialism didn't take root in any other European countries. And toward this effect, they began channeling not only raw materials, but also technological know-how, and in many cases, entire weapon systems were given to the fascists. Now, it's worth taking note of a phenomenon which is central to the understanding of the German war economy. Now, the Treaty of Versailles, by which the Allies imposed very severe restrictions on the Germans, made provisions for an enormous, really exorbitant reparations payments to be paid by Germany to the victorious Allies in World War I. Now, eventually, Germany proved unable to pay these loans, and so basically, the impasse was resolved when a group of, I guess you'd call them financier diplomats. In other words, they were financiers by trade who had become diplomats, at least by present occupation. They got together and provided a series of loans. They basically drew up two programs, one called the Dawes Plan and one called the Young Plan, which provided a series of loans to be made to Germany. And Germany was then able to pay off Britain and France, which in turn paid back the United States. And the diplomats who arranged this were, generally speaking, representatives of the very financial institutions which profited from these loans. Now, between 1924 and 1931, Germany, or 1933, I should say, Germany borrowed a total of 28 million marks, whereas they paid out, or 28 billion perhaps it was, and they took 28 billion marks, and they paid out a total of 31 billion, so that the net payment was only 3 billion marks, so that it was sort of like a financial hydraulic system. Now, what these loans did, these loan programs, the Dawes and Young Plan did, was to basically accelerate an already existing pattern in German industry in which we saw a large concentration of economic power.
Let me just toss in one thing here parenthetically, which is that this whole section of Germany's preparing for war and the support on the part of various Western national interests and business interests, which were so key to this whole thing coming together so that Germany could once again be an effective war machine and a threat to the Soviet Union, is an exceedingly complex thing, which, even though we are going to spend some time on it right now tonight, is something that we cannot possibly get into with enough depth to begin to tell the whole story. However, coming up in May, we are going to be once again, as we do every year, airing a broadcast here on KFJC called Uncle Sam and the Swastika, which we will be airing over Memorial Day on KFJC. It is also a long broadcast dealing almost entirely with this particular period of time, with the rebuilding of the German war machine and with the aid from U.S. industrial sources to the nascent Nazi German military empire. So that which we do not have time to touch on tonight, we will in fact, or we have in the past, and it's on tape and you will get a chance to hear it, has been dealt with in Uncle Sam and the Swastika.
Okay, now, remember the Dawes and Young Plan, or, well, I should say, before we're getting into that, one of the things that the Dawes and Young Plan did, this series of reparations loans which was made to Germany, did was to accelerate the pattern of concentration of economic power, which was already in evidence in Germany. Basically, the big were getting bigger, the rich were getting richer, and out of this pattern of increased economic concentration, you had three giant cartels. There were a lot of large German industrial interests, but chief among them were three cartels, three international monopolies. In other words, companies which not only dominated a given area of trade in that country, but were international monopolies as well. Now, these three cartels were the IG Farben industry, which basically represented a formal consolidation of the old German dye trust, which had dominated the petrochemical industry and the dye industries in the world, and also was very much involved with the petroleum trade after a while. The IG Farben industry was one of the giant trusts that arose out of this pattern of increased economic concentration. Another one was the Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel, which had significant capital participation from American interests, just like IG Farben did. And the third of these cartels was German General Electric, or AEG, 30% owned by American GE. And many, many American financial institutions, lending institutions, and industrial institutions actually had significant capital participation in these cartels. And these cartels were consolidated, at least in part, using some of the reparations loans that were made. Those companies which received these loans were then able to use them to buy out their competition and to outproduce them, to finance new product lines and so forth. So these reparations loans had a great deal to do with producing this pattern of economic concentration. Now, there's a figure who was responsible for drawing up the Dawes Plan, the most important of the two plans which resulted in the reparations loans and the concentration of German economic power. Now, I'm going to read you from a book called Dulles. It's by a man named Leonard Mosley, M-O-S-L-E-Y. It was published in hardcover by the Dial Press in 1978. It's the biography of John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Eleanor Dulles. John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower's Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles, former CIA director. And take a look at who drew up the Dawes Plan. Foster was in a good position to help because in prestige he had gone up considerably in the world. He had won international attention among lawyers and statesmen in 1923 and 4, when at the request of J.P. Morgan, he had been retained as special counsel to the Dawes Committee. Okay, so John Foster Dulles is special counsel to the Dawes Committee. This was a body which had been formed by Secretary Charles Evans Hughes to try to get some order into the post-war reparations problem. The same Hughes referred to, by the way, by the editorial in the New York World, which condemned, or I've forgotten which paper it was, but which condemned Messrs. Hughes and Hoover for their anti-Soviet activities. Anyway, this was a body which had been formed by Secretary Charles Evans Hughes to try to get some order into the post-war reparations problem. As Foster, Keynes, and Monet had predicted, the whole thing was in a mess. The Germans had proved unable to pay the huge debts which the victorious British and French had piled upon them. President Coolidge had urged the two allies to go easy on the Germans, but since he was at the same time demanding that they pay back their own debts to the United States, they were in no mood to do that. Foster came up with a proposal that was adopted in 1924 and became the so-called Dawes Plan, whereby the United States lent money to Germany, which in turn paid off the British and French, who then paid back the United States. Financially speaking, it was a mad sort of merry-go-round, but it gave the statesmen a breathing space. Foster would have preferred to have forged an agreement to limit reparations to a fixed sum, but settled for the best solution he could get through. His efforts were widely recognized and praised. Okay, now, John Foster Dulles is the man who draws up the Dawes Plan. Now, this is worth noting because John Foster, later, of course, Eisenhower's Secretary of State and a key figure in the modern Cold War, John Foster Dulles and his brother Alan Dulles were senior partners in the powerful Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Now, Sullivan and Cromwell handled all of the legal... Sullivan and Cromwell was very much involved with the German industrial concerns which supported Hitler, brought him to power, and then comprised the backbone of his war-making industry when he went to war. And the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm handled the legal business for American IG, IG Farben's American subsidiary, and they also were very closely affiliated with the financial empire of a man named Baron Kurt von Schroeder. Now, he was a key Nazi industrialist who had more connections than a switchboard, and we're going to tell you all about General and Baron Kurt von Schroeder in our Uncle Sam and the Swastika program in this series. But suffice it to say that the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, of whom the senior partners were Allen and John Foster Dulles, was very, very much involved with Nazi industry. And keep that in mind, because Allen and John Foster Dulles are two names we're going to come across in the future.
Now, at this time, of course, besides the manipulations that were going on to enable Germany to get out from under its reparation burden in such a way that they could then take advantage of that and begin rebuilding their war machine, there was a lot more, perhaps one could say, overt aid to the German war machine. Perhaps not always intentionally, but certainly it was there. And one can debate on the motives of the people involved as one wants to. The point of fact was that quite a few bits of the Allied war materials and Allied war secrets that had been developed, particularly in the area of air war, which had gone through a quantum leap since World War I and up to the early days preceding World War II, made their way into the German war arsenal. Now, one of these examples that we're going to quote to you from Facts and Fascism by George Sildes is a suggestion as to how perhaps it was that the Germans found out about dive bombing and became such effective dive bombers with the Stuka aircraft. And once again, this is from Facts and Fascism, and Sildes writes as follows. At the moment of writing, which means back in 1943 when this was published, at the moment of writing, Senator Harry Truman's latest report against the Curtis Wright Company is a national sensation. But among the little-known facts is the munitions investigation report showing that Curtis Wright, now Curtis Wright, of course, is still around. They're a major U.S. Aerospace company. They have large participation in Western Union. They're a big company, and they're still around today. Among the little-known facts, Sildes writes, is the munitions investigation report showing that Curtis Wright is the actual originator of the Stuka bombing idea, and that when Hitler came into power, Curtis Wright joined the DuPonts, Pratt and Whitney, and others in secretly arming Nazism for world conquest. The evidence includes a letter sent in January 1934 by the president of Curtis Wright to his salesmen in foreign lands. It says, quote, "We have been nosing around in the bureau in Washington and find that they hold as most strictly confidential their dive bombing tactics and procedure, and they frown upon our even mentioning dive bombing in connection with the Hawks or any other airplanes to any foreign powers." Once again, let me just insert parenthetically that if you will recall, at the end of World War I, usage of airplanes in war had barely gone past the stage. They had just thought of the idea of dropping bombs. They were extremely rickety, unstable crafts with no particular cruising distance whatsoever and limited maneuverability, et cetera, et cetera. So airplanes were almost not a factor at all except for observation in World War I. But already by the 1930s and early 1940s, they had become one of the major elements to be used in warfare. Anyway, going on with Sildes quoting from a letter from the president of Curtis Wright. "It is also unwise and unethical at this time, and probably for some time to come, for us to indicate that we know anything about the technique and tactics of dive bombing. However, it may be all right to put on a dive bombing show to show the strength of the airplanes. But to refer in contracts to dive bombing or endeavor to teach dive bombing is what I am cautioning against doing." Now, for those of you who had a little trouble since I broke that letter in the middle, let me point out exactly what's going on in this letter. The president of Curtis Wright is writing to his salesmen, telling them it is against the law and the government right now is scared to death that we're going to tip off the secret of dive bombing. He says, "So whatever you do, don't refer in contracts to dive bombing, and don't set up classes in dive bombing, but take the airplanes out, and you can show them how it's done." Okay, so that's in essence what he's telling them, is that make the sale, teach them how to dive bomb without expressly admitting that you're teaching them how to dive bomb. Seldes goes on to say, "This was an open order to the salesmen of Curtiss Wright planes to put on shows of dive bombings and let foreign nations, including Hitler's Germany, learn the secrets which were being guarded by the Navy Department, which had invented the technique before Hitler came into power. The Curtiss Wright Company committed the equivalent of an act of treason in order to sell its airplanes abroad. It helped make Hitler. It is apparent," reads the Senate report, this is Truman's report, "that American aviation companies did their part to assist Germany's air armament. It seems apparent also that there was not an adequate check on the foreign shipments by the War and Navy Department." Okay, now, let me just stress again, a crucial point here is this is by no means this was just the tip of the iceberg, a huge iceberg of intentional and unintentional assistance being given to Germany, a formerly hostile power, to arm and rearm itself, in some people's minds, especially the people who are helping intentionally, with the express purpose of then turning Germany as a weapon against the Soviet Union.
Now, keep in mind that, as we saw in the first hour of the program, that Article 12 of the Versailles Treaty, the armistice between Germany and the Allied powers, allowed Germany, even at the end of the First World War, to keep its troops in the Baltic states, and basically already, even as the combat of World War One was drawing to a close, warring nations, Germany and the Western Allies, were willing to join forces in some ways, were willing to cooperate, even though they were still wartime enemies, in order to further their mutual interests against the Soviet Union. And this is a pattern which begins to accelerate dramatically with the rise of fascism and the industrial support lent to the fascists, particularly Hitler's Germany, by these reactionary industrialists all around the world. And it's worth noting that this, as we'll cover at greater length on our Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast in this series, this industrial support lent by these financiers and businessmen to Nazi Germany was absolutely essential to the war-making potential of the Third Reich. Without it, Hitler could not have gone to war. Hitler, a few quick examples, Hitler's two largest tank producers were Adam Opel AG and Ford of Cologne, wholly owned subsidiaries of General Motors and the Ford Motor Company, respectively. As we've seen, the Stuka, the infamous German dive bomber, which plagued many a refugee column during World War II, was given the dive bombing technique and design was given to Nazi Germany by the Curtiss Wright Corporation. Also, ITT, a subsidiary of the ITT Corporation, manufactured the Focke Wulf, another of Hitler's top-line aircraft. All of this is to say that without this aid, Hitler could not have gone to war. There would have been no World War II.
I just thought, we might want to mention some of the collusion between the oil companies and IG Farben, and of course Torkel Rebert, who I always thought was such a sensational character.
Yeah, he was a fellow, the Germans called him, "He who walks over corpses of his own making," was their nickname for him. Torkel Rebert was the president of Texaco Oil, was very pro-Nazi, and he not only supported Franco's fascist government in its illegal and successful rebellion against the legitimately elected democratic government of Spain, but in addition, Torkel Rieber also made a deal with Hermann Göring, the Reichsmarshal, the Marshal of the Third Reich, to sell oil to the German Navy. And when you read about the torpedoing of the merchant convoys in the North Atlantic during World War II, keep in mind that much of the oil provided to those U-boats was provided by Texaco and also later Standard Oil. And keep in mind that a third of all of the merchant seamen who sailed the North Atlantic lost their lives during World War II.
I also believe that, if I am correct, that Torkel Rebert, president of Texaco Oil, actually gave a party in the Waldorf Astoria to celebrate the taking of Paris by the Nazi army, the German army, right? Right.
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
There you go.
Keep in mind now that this German-American industrial axis is central to Hitler's war-making plans, okay? Now, in general, the massive support being given by Western industrialists, chiefly American industrialists, because we were the dominant industrial power at the time, and of course still are, the massive aid being given to Hitler and the fascist governments, generally speaking, went unnoticed. There weren't too many people calling attention to it. Now, one of the very few organizations or interests to attempt to get to the bottom of the industrialists, of the Western industrialists' support for Hitler and their arming of Hitler, was a Senate committee known as the Nye Committee, or a congressional committee known as the Nye Committee. Now, Senator Nye, and along with Senators Bone and Truman, were very concerned with the munitions makers and industrialists and their aid to Hitler, so they formed a committee to look into it. Now, the fellow who was in many ways the driving force behind the Nye Committee and steering it in the direction of investigating these American and German industrial connections was a fellow by the name of Alger Hiss, last name H-I-S-S. Alger Hiss was a young, very intelligent New Deal lawyer, and Alger Hiss acted as legal counsel to the Nye Committee, which was investigating the munitions makers and industrialists' aid to Germany. And basically, Alger Hiss was one of the very few people who was willing to go out on a limb and to devote some effort to trying to uncover these fascist connections that American and other and Western... Well, basically, the Nye Committee was concerned with American connections to Nazi Germany.